Our second speaker this morning is John Studenroth. Dr. Studenroth will be speaking to us on the subject of plant evolution. In the front page of your notebook, you have a list of his qualifications. He's an instructor of biology at Pinebrook Junior College and pastor of Pennridge Community Church, Bachelor of Science in Botany from the University of Maine, MS from the same institution in Botany and Plant Pathology, PhD in Plant Pathology from Cornell University, Master of Arts in Biblical Studies and Master of Divinity from Biblical Seminary, and he is a PhD candidate. Is that also in Ancient Near Eastern Studies from Dropsy University? And he'll be speaking to us on the subject of plant evolution. John.
Thank you, Dr. Newman. When they start stringing out the degrees like that, you always say, I'm dying by degrees. The secret is, if you go to Biblical Seminary and you get a Master's of Divinity, for $15, they'll give you another Master's. And so you keep stringing those degrees out. It looks very impressive. But okay, today we're going to be looking at plants. And before I turn on the overhead, I would like somebody to just name a plant for me. Could somebody just name a plant that comes to mind? A rose, okay. Typical, almost anything you name, except somebody just said fern there to mess me up, but almost anything you name is an angiosperm. Plants that typically come to mind are angiosperms, and we'll see there's a good reason for that here in a moment. In your notebook, I have a simple outline of plants in your notes there. And here on the overhead, a slightly more thorough outline of plants. What are we talking about when we talk about plants? We are actually spanning 4 out of 5 kingdoms typically recognized nowadays by biologists. We're cutting quite a wide swath through the biosphere, you might say, through all living organisms, starting with the most simple prokaryotes, our bacteria, moving through all the various eukaryotes. The only kingdom we're leaving out is Kingdom Animalia, the true multicellular animals. Everything else has its plant representatives in it. And of course, Kingdom Fungi would be strictly given to the botanists, although it's not photosynthetic. I'm not going to bore you with all these different taxonomies here, but I think you can see there's quite a lot involved. Kingdom Monera includes our true bacteria, sometimes called the eubacteria, EU. And that includes the little critters you see up there in the top left-hand corner, the little guys that turn your milk sour for you. The other pictures I have on this overhead are cyanobacteria, formerly called blue-green algae. And of all the things in the Monera, these would perhaps be most representative of plants. They conduct photosynthesis very much like the higher plants do, and that is they use water as their electron source. They split the water, releasing oxygen. A lot of other bacteria have chemosynthetic and other types of photosynthetic pathways. They may use hydrogen sulfide and give off sulfur. But the cyanobacteria, the blue-green algae, which we'll be looking at again this morning, are very close to our plants and very complicated as a result in their biochemistry. I have some pretty pictures down here at the bottom. B, this one up here, is a nostoc. Notice the large heterocysts in the filament. Those actually do nitrogen fixation, also a somewhat complicated biochemical dealie. And over here in C, we have oscillatoria, which is illustrated here, and all kinds of other pretty forms of these things. Somebody has counted 7,500 different named species. There's a lot of argument. These things are really tough to do the taxonomy. Some people would reduce it to about 200 species. So given a lot of flux between 200 and 7,500, let's just say there's a lot of pretty things out there called blue-green algae. What's the difference between a prokaryote and a eukaryote? When we leave Kingdom Monera, what are we talking about? Here are 2 freeze-etch electron micrographs in which the specimen is frozen, cracked open, and then treated in such a way that we get a replica of the surface. And down beneath is an artist's conception of it with the label so we can see what's going on. Here is our blue-green algae once again. Notice thylakoid, a photosynthetic membrane that pretty much runs throughout the entire organism. Unlike the eukaryote, which also has a thylakoid, but it's contained in a chloroplast. Our prokaryote has no true nucleus. It has a nuclear area. It has a big loop of DNA that governs its genetic material, but it doesn't have a true nucleus with a nuclear membrane, nuclear pores, and it's really lacking a lot of other membrane-bound organelles, such as Golgi body, etc., chloroplasts, true mitochondria. But it's still very complicated. The biochemistry in the prokaryote is nothing to sneeze at. There's still an awful lot going on there. So there we are, moving from Kingdom Monera now into Kingdom Protista, shall we say, for the next step.
Once we get into the eukaryotic organisms, we begin to find a lot of things called algae. Algae is a difficult term. It spans a lot of things. As I said, the blue-green bacteria, cyanobacteria, for a long time we called blue-green algae. There's a lot of things in protista, single-celled things that people call algae. And there's a lot of things that are in the kingdom Plantae that people call algae. Rather large, the seaweeds along the coast are really algae. So algae, in the common sense of the word, covers an awful lot. Here I have listed six divisions of eukaryotic algae. Green algae, brown algae, red algae, a lot of those are seaweeds. And then smaller things, diatoms, dinoflagellates, euglenoids. They differ, and they end up in these various groups by the taxonomists according to things like photosynthetic pigments, how they store their food reserves, what exactly what kind of carbohydrate, the number of flagella, where they're located, cell wall components, how they're built, and some other remarks here. Fairly good system to break these into these categories. And we'll see later, as we try to construct phylogenies, these things do become important. As we move up from the algae into the so-called land plants, we find there are non-vascular plants called bryophytes, and the vascular plants referred to as the tracheophytes. Big difference here is your bryophytes don't have true vascular tissue, such as phloem and xylem. Is this a microphone resting here?
Is this being,
it's being used. Because I keep resting my hand on it, probably killing somebody's tape recorder. Sorry about that. No vascular tissue then in the bryophytes, and the vascular tissue is present in the tracheophytes. Other things that are of significance for us, that the lack of vascular tissue restricts the bryophytes to a very moist environment. They like the shady, wet areas. Not only because they don't have roots, but their reproductive system really demands it too, as we may have time to look at a little later. The tracheophytes have a wide range of habitats. They have truly adapted to dry land and can therefore fit almost any niche. Just a quick overview of the lower vascular plants then, the simpler tracheophytes. We have class Lycopsida, Sphenopsida, Phyllocopsida, better known as club mosses and horsetails and ferns. The thing that's interesting about these classes is there's a lot more fossil forms many times than there are living forms. It's like the Lord had a lot of things in these classes at one time, and they're extinct. And some of them are pretty elaborate and quite large and, I think, quite handsome. And today we often have just a few small representatives, both in terms of their number and size. If I have time at the end, I want to comment about that. The extinction of many species is sometimes troubling to people, and I have a certain philosophy about that, which I hope we have time to discuss. Let's get back to the Precambrian now for a moment. We're moving to part two of my talk on scanning the fossils. That first part was all about setting the parameters. What are we talking about when we say plants? Now I want to zero in on what fossil evidence do we have of these various kingdoms. Starting with our kingdom Monera, we have evidence that goes way back. And what I have on this particular overhead, the colored areas show where ancient Precambrian platforms are found in the world today. Many are a long way from the original positions because continental drift has moved the land masses considerably since they're first deposited. But you'll notice there is a lot of Precambrian material in the world, and there are some famous locations that are marked here by name where microfossils have been discovered. Bacteria-like microfossils have been reported from the fig tree chert. C-H-E-R-T, chert, refers to a kind of rock, a silicon dioxide. If you want the details on that, I refer you to Dr. Phillips, who's the geologist here and can help with all the details of how these things form. But in South Africa, we have then evidence of bacteria more than 3 billion years old. And actually, the rock underlying the fig tree chert, and I'm not sure the exact pronunciation of this Unverlucht formation, but it is older yet, and it too has microfossils, and that is about 3.4 to 3.6 billion years old. What exactly are these various microfossils? Well, there is some room for disagreement, but the Gunflint formation, indicated here in Ontario on the shores of Lake Superior, is quite clear. There we have excellent preserved, three-dimensional, almost like they're embedded in plastic, microfossils. And some resemble very closely Oscillatoria, one of those blue-green algae I showed you on an earlier overhead, and other microfossil forms resembling other modern bacteria, including an iron-oxidizing bacteria, Crinofix. So it looks like we have some things way, way, way back that aren't that much different from a lot of things that are running around today. Another formation in South Africa that's about 3 billion years old is the Bulawayan limestone. I don't believe that one's indicated on this overhead. Again, 3 billion years old on that one, excuse me.
believed to be photosynthetic microorganisms. And then the oldest definite fossils are stromatolites. Stromatolites are actually mats left behind by blue-green algae and similar small creatures. These are not necessarily the fossils of the organisms themselves, but a type of mat formation they leave behind. In this area called the North Pole, it's really not the North Pole, it's down in Western Australia, but that location referred to as the North Pole by name, we have found perhaps the oldest evidence of anything living on Earth, 3.5 or more billion years old, stromatolites, evidently left behind layer after layer of sediment that they laid down. Let me just put an overhead up here that shows some stromatolites. What are we talking about when we say stromatolites? It's not the clearest picture in the world, but I think you can see this individual out here walking on these domes. This comes from North Greenland, and these are indicated about 900 million years old, 0.9 billion. But the ones in Australia, as I mentioned, are 3.5 billion years old. How do they form? You have algae growing in mats that trap fine-grained carbonate sediment. And as they grow upward, they continue to lay down these layers of carbonate mud and sand that they trap. And after many years, you just find many concentric layers forming these domes, sometimes rather small domes, other times quite large, as we see here in the Greenland formation. The little layers are, as it says here, typically a few millimeters thick, each layer that's laid down. Okay. So although the algae themselves then are rarely preserved as fossils, these stromatolitic deposits are well known and indeed have been useful in determining ancient shorelines because they tend to grow in tidal zones in the shallow areas. Let me just return for a moment to my Precambrian platform overhead here. The 1 billion year old Bitter Springs Formation indicated here, that's called Northern Territory of Australia. I realize it doesn't look that northern, but that's Northern Territory. Has revealed prokaryotes and possibly some eukaryotes of about 30 different species 1 billion years ago. Some of the blue-green algae, again, in this area are indistinguishable from forms we have today. I'm going to rest the overhead for a moment here. Can I have a little bit of light? Some source. Thank you. I want to, at this point, quickly go over the Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic with you. You have it in your notebook there under scanning the fossils. I want to do this quickly and just say that in the Paleozoic era, from about 600 to 225 million years ago, we had this Cambrian explosion of eukaryotic organisms, lots of algae of different types. By the Silurian period, we're getting the earliest evidence of land plants, and interestingly enough, vascular land plants. And then in the Devonian period, this is a very crucial period in paleobotany, the Devonian period indicated 395 to 345 million years ago is a tremendous explosion in vascular land plants, diversification of all types. And then, of course, you're all familiar with the Carboniferous period and all the beautiful things that get laid down in the coal beds. And then a lot of things went extinct in the Permian period. A lot of these plants are gone by that time or during that time. Later, we get gymnosperms that survive through the Permian and into the later periods. Angiosperms do not appear at all, however, until page 3 there of your notes, the Cretaceous period, 135 to 65 million years ago. Angiosperms explode on the scene rather suddenly, no obvious connection to anything before them. Therefore, there's a lot of debate between paleobotanists. What is the link to the angiosperms? Angiosperms are, like I mentioned at the beginning, when people name a plant, it's what you usually name, roses. Whatever you tend to think of that has a flower is an angiosperm. Flowers and fruits. Matter of fact, if you notice on page 1, when I listed the various species, when it came to angiosperms on the very bottom of page 1, 275,000 species, flowering and fruiting plants, both monocots and dicots, approximately 6 times the number of species of all other plant groups combined. So, I mean, it's an explosion to rival the Cambrian explosion. We call it our angiosperm explosion. And they quickly took over the world and were very successful. Okay, at this point, then, I want to consider some putative scenarios. How do we fit this all together? We have all this evidence in the fossils from the earliest Precambrian blue-green algae up to this angiosperm explosion. How are paleobotanists trying to put it together? With lots of disagreement, I think would be fair to say. There's certain basic outlines that everybody agrees to, and then there's lots of room for tinkering with the phylogenetic pathways. I want to try to point out today some major things I think people pretty much agree with, and then some problem areas. Okay, starting then with our green algae, which most people think is where it all starts. Where do the higher plants come from? Most paleobotanists would say you go back to your eukaryotic green algae, which somehow, of course, came from your prokaryotic blue-green cyanobacteria. The green algae have many protist-like representatives, that is, single-celled eukaryotes, as well as some rather large multicellular things. And therefore, you can almost picture the green algae, division Chlorophyta, as spanning two kingdoms. It's like it has a good foot in the protist kingdom and a good foot in the plant kingdom, Plantae. It's often been suggested, then, that green algae are probably the ancestors of all our vascular plants. Indeed, their cells, their biochemistry, and their life cycles greatly resemble those of our modern plants. I refer you to reference number 12 in the bibliography, Linda Graham, 1985. You might just want to check that. If you're interested in this whole argument about our higher forms of plants coming from the green algae, that would be a good review article to catch up on that. By contrast, the remaining classes of algae, the browns and the reds, which you think of as various seaweeds probably along the coast, the kelps and the things that we see, these are so different from the green algae that paleobotanists and taxonomists generally agree that there's no close connection. They are independent lines of macroevolution, if you please. Let me put on a typical scenario here of... Yeah, if you want to get the light out again. I'm looking for my... Here it is, handy-dandy cover. Okay. Here we have a typical, simple introductory biology textbook phylogenetic scheme, starting with our ancestral green algae, coming off one side, interestingly enough, of the bryophytes, the non-vascular land plants, the mosses and the liverworts, continuing right up the line to our modern green algae from the ancestral. Coming off the other side, viewed very independent evolution, would be our vascular plants, first primitive gymnosperms and our ferns, more modern gymnosperms, and then the angiosperms, indicated by the monocots and the dicots. That's a very simple overview. I did move my notes over here. Botanists speculate that the bryophytes, which are indicated here by mosses, liverworts, and hornworts, and the tracheophytes, then, represent two independent evolutionary lines that descended from green algal ancestors. Remember, the bryophytes I pointed out on the earlier overhead are non-vascular, no roots, no true leaves and stems per se, no vascular tissue like phloem and xylem. They have the haploid gametophyte generation, which is dominant. But that doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry about it. But for those who are a little bit into botany, the bryophytes have a dominant haploid 1N generation and a reduced 2N diploid generation, just the opposite of the tracheophytes, another reason why botanists split them into separate evolutionary lines. I think most important, though, and perhaps most vexing to any phylogeny, is that the fossil evidence would indicate that the tracheophytes came earlier, certainly just as early and probably earlier than the bryophytes. And that doesn't seem all that logical. The bryophytes would have been a nice thing to be the first things out of the water and up onto the dry land, both by means of their simplicity, they have not yet evolved a vascular system, and yet they've managed to adapt and survive close to the shores, plus they break down rocks, they grow on rocks, they don't have roots, but they grow over rocks, and then as they secrete their acids and whatnot, they break down rocks, they add to that their own organic matter as they die and decay, great for building soil. So if I were going to construct a phylogeny from scratch without looking at the fossil record too hard, I would say the bryophytes, of course, would come first, and then they prepare the way for the tracheophytes. Fossil evidence would indicate tracheophytes did their thing first. Bryophytes were a second afterthought that came along a little bit later. Here's a slightly more sophisticated phylogeny, two of them, actually, starting with our earliest cells, moving up to bacteria, cyanobacteria. Off to the side, the Rhodophyta, the red algae. Another branch, the brown algae, Phyophyta. The separate branch here, the Chlorophyta, the green algae, from which we then go to our land plants. Coming over here and starting with the green algae, we come up through a particular division of green algae that you'll find mentioned in Linda Graham's article. And then off to the side, the bryophytes. And not indicating that they're earlier, but showing the uncertainty in the whole thing because we don't have the links. Showing by dotted line here the tracheophytes. I think in all fairness, there should be a dotted line to the bryophytes, too, because we don't have a nice sequence of links. But then, off to the side, the club mosses, up through something called progymnosperms. From that, our various gymnosperms today, like our horsetails, the conifers, the ginkgo, the vessel-bearing gymnosperms, ferns, something called seed ferns, which don't exist anymore. They were like our ferns, but they had true seeds. And then things that we still do have today, the cycads, and up to our angiosperms once again. So this would be another typical scheme for trying to fit together. But notice every once in a while a dotted line, a break, especially here where our angiosperms take off. We're guessing that they're coming from something, but we don't know what the links really are. I want to, at this point, discuss some different groups or divisions of vascular plants. Just saying that the tracheophytes evolved is one thing, but it's of even more interest. While vascular plants may have arisen more than once, paleobotanists today speak of division Rhyniophyta, division Zosterophyllophyta, and division Trimerophyta. I hope you can read these on the dark background here. But the Zosterophyllophyta are different enough in life habit, in their growth habit, in their life cycles, that botanists tend to think of them as distinct. But then there's no common linkage point. We don't have some good ancestor from which you can say, well, they both are arising from this. Your Rhyniophyta have terminal sporangia on the ends of branches, leafless aerial stalks, something called centrifugal maturation of xylem cells, and that means they'll start from the center and mature outward. The Zosterophyllophyta do just the opposite. Their xylem matures from the outside in, and they have lateral-borne sporangia. But they're both about the same age. You go back 400 million years to the Silurian period for the Rhyniophyta. You go back 395 million years for the Zosterophyllophyta. How did these two groups, where is the common ancestor? And if it isn't a common ancestor, if you're going to say that tracheophytes happen to occur twice independently, it's going to begin to raise interesting questions, as we'll see a little later, because tracheophytes do share very important things in common. To adapt to the dry land, they develop xylem, phloem, vascular system. That's not simple stuff. John Bloom, my buddy, had just picked up a book I had laying in the motel room to use while I went to the bathroom. He came out and he said, plants are really complicated, aren't they? It was Catherine Esau's plant anatomy text with all these gruesome pictures of phloem and xylem labeling all these delicate parts. And a lot of detail there. It's complicated. Did this really happen twice? You need cuticles to protect these leaves from losing everything by evaporation. But then you need stomates, the little openings in leaves, the pores that open and close with guard cells around them. Did these things happen more than once independently? Some phylogenies that are presented today would suggest that maybe that happened. I said earlier that the earliest vascular land plants then belong to these groups, Zosterophyllophyta, Rhyniophyta, and go back about 400 million years in the late Silurian. I should mention in passing here that there is some evidence, fragmentary evidence, that our vascular plants go back even a little bit further. And let me just put an overhead here that shows that. Going back to the late Silurian, possible land plants from actually the early Silurian of Virginia include a little fragment of cuticle, what's called a trilet mark on a spore, which is usually indicative of the tracheophytes, and most interesting of all, some tubes that look like the vascular tissues, especially this one that has the lignification, the cross markings on it. Looks a lot like a tracheid, something you'd only find, when you find tubes, you start thinking vascular plants, you start thinking land plants. So this has pushed it back a little bit earlier. Indeed, to sort of put it all together, let me put an overhead here that has a chart. I believe this is a misprint, where they have upper Ordovician, and they show the first land plants representing this cuticle, the tracheid, the trilet spore. That should be up one notch. That was really in the lower Silurian. The upper Ordovician has indicated, there has been revealed in that layer, some assemblages of microfossils that look like spores that some have argued are higher plants. But in terms of the cuticle, the trachea, that goes up one notch. Here we have more distinct tracheids, little early plant called Cooksonia. But it's about middle Silurian where we begin to develop the rhyniophytes, which many then believe lead to the trimerophytes, which then lead to a lot of stuff we see today. Off to the side, indicated by a broken dotted line that doesn't really connect to anything, is this suggested Zosterophyllite. Yeah, Zosterophyllophytes. Get that right yet? Which are different enough that they're not too quick to link the two together. And yet I said, if they occurred separately, we've got some problems explaining some real important common features. All that's left today, incidentally, of that whole chain are a few club masses, our lycopods. At one time, a very large group, now reduced to a handful of small species. Interestingly enough, though, those few small species we have do a lot of things like the old ancient Zostera phyllites did, inheriting this centripetal formation of the xylem from the outside in. Some of these characteristics still persist even in our modern club mosses. Now, I'm going to think with you for a moment, what are some of the major problems? Roman numeral 4 on page 3 of your handout, what are some major problems with all macroevolutionary schemes for interpreting this fossil evidence? And I'm going to have to do these rather quickly. We're going to sort of fly over a couple of these. But one thing we need to wrestle with is the origin of eukaryotes and multicellularity. We come out of the Precambrian with evidence of prokaryotes. And I showed you the difference between a prokaryote and a eukaryote, and there's some very significant differences. It's a major increase in complexity with membrane-bound organelles, Golgi bodies, mitochondria, chloroplasts. That's a big area to explore. They call it the Cambrian explosion. We suddenly seem to have a lot of eukaryotic things, both plant and animal. What brought this about? How did this occur? Some people have suggested, and I don't think it's a terrible idea, that little bacteria crawled inside something else. So you have some of these blue-green algae that look a lot like a chloroplast. And so maybe one of them took up residence like a buddy inside somebody else who was a little bit bigger and finally said, I'll make food for you. I'll photosynthesize sugars for you if you carry me around to protect me and get me into the sunlight where I can do my thing. That sounds a little corny, but it's not a totally absurd idea because we have modern examples of that. Here is a living blue-green symbiont. This little guy here is a cyanobacteria symbiont who's crawled inside, in this case, Cyanophora, protist. The cyanobacterium produces food for itself and its host. Cyanophora uses its flagellum to move to areas where light is available for the photosynthesis of its symbiont. Notice the many layers of photosynthetic membranes, the thylakoids here in this blue-green algae or cyanobacteria. It looks a lot like a chloroplast, and it's acting like one. It has become what we call an endosymbiont, and this guy says, I'll carry you around and you make food for me. So I don't laugh totally at the notion that maybe we can explain some of our eukaryotic features by such a mechanism. I say that's not answering all the questions. When we moved from a prokaryote to a eukaryote, we didn't just take on board a mitochondria or a chloroplast. We developed a lot of new, it's a whole package of new features. And we're talking about a much more complex nucleus with a nuclear membrane. We're talking about an endoplasmic reticulum with ribosomes all over. We're talking about bigger ribosomes than the bacteria have. We're not talking about one or two changes. We're talking about a package deal of changes. You go to buy a new car, you get package options. We've got a whole package of new options, very sophisticated options. And as somebody once pointed out, sometimes in evolution, these package option deals that we get are so good that we essentially transform your Volkswagen into a Cadillac. And how do you do that one nut and bolt at a time? You know, how do you change from a Volkswagen prokaryote to a Cadillac eukaryote by saying, well, first change the transmission? It's not going to fit. We're talking about big changes, significant changes that involve the whole organism. And you don't just add one thing at a time. It's a system. At the other end of the spectrum, I'd like to consider a problematic area, which I've already alluded to. That's the origin of the angiosperms. They seem to burst on the scene with great success, and they have a package of new features. I just want to quickly summarize those. They have more efficient vascular tissue, better xylem and phloem. They have greatly reduced gametophytes, which develop quickly and go on to the rapid formation of seeds. They have a whole new reproductive strategy of flowers. See, before angiosperms, there are no such things as sepals and petals and stamens, ovules, ovaries, stigma, style, anther, filaments, all these things that make beautiful Easter lilies. There was no such thing. It all comes as a package. Double fertilization, which is a unique reproductive act in angiosperms, where pollen releases two haploid sperm nuclei. One fertilizes an egg nucleus to give a zygote nucleus 2N. Another fertilizes the polar nucleus to give something called 3N endosperm nucleus, which divides rapidly and makes 3NN nutritive tissue called endosperm. I'm just rattling this off to let you know. There's a lot of stuff comes in this package. And so these things called seeds, with their endosperm and the thing around it called fruit, which you call an apple and an orange and a banana, is a whole new strategy in the plant world. The developed ovary that becomes fruit, including a lot of pollination strategies, are really new. That's a problem that needs to be looked at. Another problem is why the tracheophytes before the bryophytes. I've mentioned that already. Why do the bryophytes, why even bother with bryophytes once you've got tracheophytes? I'm speaking teleologically, of course, but you say, we don't need them anymore. We've mastered the land far better. What are you introducing these non-vascular bryophytes at this late date for? Okay, another problem that I'd like to consider are the green algae. I said they're the ancestors to the higher plants, but the fact remains the fossil record has not revealed the nature of the organisms that were supposedly transitional between them and various forms we have today. There's a lot of missing links. I want to zero in now on the brown algae for a moment. So let me go back to an earlier overhead here. Brown algae, phyophyta. I said that it's an independent chain. We had the red algae, the rhodophyta, the brown algae, the phyophyta, the green algae, chlorophyta, and only from the green algae, the paleobotanists, taxonomists, evolutionists think we derived modern land plants. This chain, then, all by its lonesome here, phyophyta, brown algae, which you would think of as various fucus, seaweeds, the kinds of stuff along the shore that you pick up, it's all slimy, and you pop the air bladders, that kind of fun stuff. It's been suggested that these phyophyta evolved from little unicellular organisms, but the fact is we have no examples of that. There are no unicellular brown algae. We don't have any simple colonies of brown algae like this. Colonial forms, single celled. You do with the reds and the greens, but not with the browns. That's a problem. But there's a more serious problem. The vegetative structure of the so-called kelps, big Pacific kelps, for example, can grow 70 meters long. They have a big blade, they have a stipe and a holdfast. You go down 70 meters in the ocean, you're cutting out a lot of light. The lower parts of that kelp cannot photosynthesize. These big Pacific kelps, which are clearly brown algae, have developed vascular tissue all on their own. They've got xylem and phloem type tissue down the center of the stipe. But not only have they developed what you might consider, say, a rudimentary vascular tissue, but they have sieve plates. Say, what's a sieve plate? Well, it is a very sophisticated technique in angiosperms, not in gymnosperms, not in our conifers, but in our dicots in particular. A part of the phloem is called a sieve plate, and I'm going to do a real quick anatomical review. This is why I brought that miserable book along that John was looking at in the bathroom there, Catherine Eustall's Plant Anatomy. To try to review quickly, or perhaps first time for those that didn't have the joy of botany in school, phloem and xylem. In the conifers, we have things called sieve cells. Food that is photosynthesized in the leaves has to be transported down to the roots. The roots are bringing up water and minerals, but they need food too. And so the food is transported down through the stuff called phloem. And these particular sieve cells that we find in our conifers, our gymnosperms, are considered primitive. And I don't know if you can notice as they touch one another, but they come together in long tapering cells, and as they touch, they have pores, clusters of pores, called a sieve area. And the food is going through the sieve area from one sieve cell to the next and transported down the line, sort of zigzagging from cell to cell, left and right, getting down to the roots. It's not the most efficient system. It works, it's fine, but it's considered primitive compared to what came later in the angiosperms. And here's a case of a dicot in particular. Now we have something called a sieve tube. Not a sieve cell, but a sieve tube and a sieve plate. A sieve tube is a larger thing, and it connects usually quite well with the next tube, so we really form a very nice conduit or pipeline. We're not zigging from one narrow tapered cell to the other. We're moving down a pipeline. Now, the pipeline on the transverse ends of the pipe sections has something called a sieve plate, and it is a much more sophisticated structure. Without boring you with the details, if you want to see it, come borrow Catherine Eustall and look at all the chapters on this that she has. But a sieve plate is recognized by plant anatomists as a phylogenetically advanced, a specialized structure with the angiosperms. The question is, what's our little brown algae, our kelp in the Pacific, who's totally unrelated, who evolved in a whole separate branch long, long, long ago, what's he doing with the sieve plate and his phloem? What's the connection? The answer that is given typically to this problem and many similar problems in plant evolution is called convergent evolution. It simply runs like this. If you put enough selection pressure on something, if there's enough of a stress, organisms will evolve the same mechanism again, totally independently. Natural selection will work to create the same structure again. What we're saying is then that of all the possible things that a brown kelp could do to conduct food down to the whole vast 70 meters down into the Pacific Ocean, of all the things that could be done, it just happened that natural selection brought about these very sophisticated sieve plates, again, a second time, unrelated to the angiosperms, which have the same structure. I have trouble with that. It seems to me that natural selection could create a whole bunch of new things that would do the job. To have such similarity in structure raises, I think, fair questions to ask. Another similar problem, gymnosperms. Here are several groups that went extinct. The most interesting are called the seed ferns. I mentioned earlier there was something once called seed ferns. They're all gone now. They look like ferns, but when you study them closely, they had true seeds. Our ferns today don't have seeds. They have spores. Sometimes you ladies have ferns in your home for a beautiful house plant. You turn the leaf over, and there's all these little brown things in the bottom. Some ladies have been known to get upset and consider that a disease and wonder if they should get rid of these things. Those are the sporae that have spores in them. They're part of the natural system. Ferns produce spores. And unseen to most of us, including myself, I have to admit I've never really seen this, especially in nature, is a whole different generation of the fern called the gametophyte. These spores drop. They form this incredible little thing called a gametophyte plant, little heart-shaped thing on the forest floor, just a few millimeters big. Some sex takes place there. There's some fertilization. And that produces the sporophyte, which is the next big fern that comes up in the forest. Well, you and I just see the big ferns coming up every spring in the forest, the fiddleheads that we go out and collect. We don't see the incredible complex other generation that's so tiny. Well, these were different. These ferns produce seeds, much like our angiosperms. They're gone. We consider them gymnosperms today. And then there's another thing here called the Cordaites, another type of conifer, extinct. And then there's four divisions of conifers today. Ginkgo, our conifer trees that we consider our usual conifers. Things like this that are also considered gymnosperms. Basically six divisions of gymnosperms that all come from something called the progymnosperms. Let me back up to one of my earlier overheads here just for a moment. Progymnosperms, here they are in this one, progymnosperms. Coming from that, things like conifers, ginkgo, etc. Club mosses were before that. But the important thing here is that progymnosperms don't have seeds. Progymnosperms were still doing the thing with spores. And what looks like happening, if we're going to have separate, independent evolution of various groups of gymnosperms coming from progymnosperms, which is what's being suggested, the seed is going to emerge more than once evolutionarily. Coming back to the same problem again, different case of the same thing. Is that important, that we have seeds arising more than once? Let me read from a typical botany book the description here of a seed. The seed constitutes one of the most dramatic innovations to arise during the evolution of vascular plants. It seems to be one of the factors responsible for the dominance of seed plants in today's flora. The reason is simple. The seed has survival value with its coat, its food supply, its embryo already growing there. Instead of the single haploid cell of a spore, seeds contain many cells organized into three main parts: the outer protective seed coat, the multicellular diploid embryo of the new sporophyte generation, and a food supply that the new plant uses while its roots and leaves develop from their embryonic rudiments. The seed is an extraordinary evolutionary invention for the survival and perpetuation of terrestrial plants. That is how an evolutionist looks at the seed, and rightly so. I'm asking, would you expect six times, three times, even two times, various divisions of gymnosperms to arise from that which is called progymnosperms? Each of those requires the development of the seed. Would that have occurred on separate chains of evolution? I've mentioned vascular plants. If that's independent evolution of the Zostera phylophyta and the Rhyniophyta, that would necessitate independent evolution of the package of features like the cuticle, the stomate, the guard cells, and the xylem. Another interesting example of so-called convergent evolution, where you get a package deal more than once, is the trachids versus the vessel members. Extensive comparative studies of the tracheary elements in a wide range of vascular plants have clearly established that the trachids, indicated by these middle things here, a type of water-conducting tissue in plants, is a more primitive, less specialized type of cell than the vessel member, indicated by these squattier, fatter pipeline-type things. Incidentally, this is a very analogous, very close to what I discussed earlier with phloem, when I said phloem
sieve cells are very primitive, and sieve tube members are more advanced. A similar thing is going on with the xylem, the water-conducting tissue, primitive, advanced.
Okay, it's clearly established then that the trachea is more primitive than the squattier vessel member. The principal water-conducting cell in the xylem is angiosperms. Angiosperms go with the advanced stuff. It is quite clear, and I'm reading again, quoting from an introductory botany book, quite clear that vessel members evolved independently from tracheids in several groups of vascular plants, including the dicotyledons, the monocotyledons, the gnathophyta, which are your vessel-bearing gymnosperms. There's only one division of gymnosperms that has the true vessels instead of tracheids. Several unrelated species of ferns, and certain species of Salaginella of the lycophytes and Equisetum, the horsetails. The evolution of the vessel member is an excellent example of convergent evolution, or the independent development of similar structures by unrelated or only distantly related organisms. Just one more. There are more examples of this. I won't hit you with any more of them. What I'm saying is happening in plant evolution is that we keep getting lines of evolution that paleobotanists agree this is a distinct pathway, and then suddenly at the tips of the pathways, we find features that must have arisen independently, whether it's a certain phloem kind of vessel, a certain xylem kind of vessel, or a cuticle, stomates, or some other feature that can be rather complex. And we say, well, look, natural selection did the same thing twice. That's not a freaking plant evolution. They're invoking that explanation any number of times. If you read the more recent article in your bibliography from 1987 by Gensel and Andrews, number 9, that's a nice review article, The Evolution of Early Land Plants, from an American scientist. You will again find the invoking there of convergent evolution. So I recommend that article to you also. Now, at this point, I want to show you the final classic case, which will lead into another discussion, and that is the C4 photosynthetic pathway. This was discovered back, I believe, in the early 60s by two Australians, Hatch, Slack, perhaps some others helping them. What was discovered is that in sugarcane and a lot of our grasses, there is a very efficient form of photosynthesis, at least it's efficient in bright sunlight and somewhat dry conditions. These plants have a different anatomy and a different biochemistry. They're, again, a package deal. If you move from the C3 pathway to the C4 pathway of photosynthesis, you're talking about a new package option deal with a number of features built in. Different enzymes, different structure of tissues, and it makes the whole new system go. Briefly then, we have here a typical C3 plant. A wheat plant, for example, would tend to be C3. And you have something called palisade mesophyll, a nice upper epidermis with its cuticle and its cutin. You have a vein coming through here. You have something around the vascular tissue called bundle sheath cells, spongy mesophyll, the stomate letting the gases in. The C4 plant isn't radically different, but it has much more pronounced bundle sheath cells, larger. And what's happening, if we could look at the microscope and expand on this, is the carbon dioxide the plant is emitting and is going to make sugars out of first enters one of the mesophyll cells, where it goes through a very different biochemical pathway than the C3 plant. And the important thing about this is that the C4 system can grab carbon dioxide at much lower concentrations than the C3 system. Here we have two plants that are in, an atmosphere of limited carbon dioxide. The C4 plant can latch onto it and use it, and the C3 plant can't. That's important if you're in a dry situation and you start to close your stomates to guard your water. Here's a plant that says, man, I'm drying up, I'm going to wilt, I'm going to die, so I close my stomates to protect my water supply, but now I can't get the carbon dioxide I need. Well, the C4 plant says, I can crack my stomate open just ever so slightly, not losing much water, and whatever little carbon dioxide comes in, I can use, unlike the C3 plant. Therefore, your corn plants grow well in hot sunshine. Sometimes people say, this is great corn growing weather. Why? Because it has the C4 pathway. It's not great for some other crops. Now, we look at that. We say, that's really efficient. As a matter of fact, if you put a corn plant and a wheat plant in a bell jar and grow them in an airtight atmosphere, the wheat plant will begin to die for lack of CO2. The corn plant is taking up all the CO2 out of this bell jar. Eventually, as the wheat plant dies, it begins to respire and gives off CO2, and the corn plant takes that too. So you come back sometime later, you have this wonderful corn plant and a dead wheat plant inside this jar, because the corn plant can grab the CO2 so much better. Scientists have looked at this, and they said, this would be nice. This is more efficient. This would be really nice if we could introduce this into some plants that we want to be more efficient. For example, soybeans. Soybeans are typically C3.
Wouldn't it be neat if we could get C4 into it and make them much more productive in certain areas of the world? I now call this next part of my talk the expense. The convergent evolution can be expensive. And the reason I say that is, at the University of Illinois, for 2 years, they ran an experiment in doing exactly this. They said, surely the C4 pathway arose evolutionarily through mutations at some point in ancient history. Let's reenact that. Let us grow soybean and flax and irradiate them to maximize the mutation. Let's step up evolution. Let's irradiate them with various things that will cause mutations. Then let's put these flax of soybeans under an atmosphere that has very little CO2, called a CO2 stressed atmosphere. And let's apply natural selection. It will kill any C3 soybean, but if any of these happen to evolve the C4 pathway, it will live. For 2 years, I don't know how many people's salaries they had to pay, and how many soybeans ended up out in the dumpster. But they stressed flax of soybean plants that were irradiated for 2 years, this went on, trying to find that magic one that would be zapped just right with the right mutation, because surely it happened not just once. You study this C4 pathway, it is in a lot of different plant families. So convergent evolution, according to the current scenario, happened many, many times between C3 and C4. So it's really not that illogical using this method of thinking to do this experiment. But I can tell you the experiment was closed down, everybody cooled their heels, and they had dumpsters full of dead soybean plants, but they never did find the C4 pathway by trying to do evolution over again. It's not that simple. It's a package deal. There is anatomical changes. There are biochemical enzyme changes. You don't just zap things with radiation and hit the right package option deal. Okay, having said that, let me talk about photosynthesis itself for a moment, just general photosynthesis. You notice on your page 3 of your hand that I have Roman numeral 5, photosynthesis, the biggest jump of all. We can have the lights back on. I teach an introductory biology course, and I always tell my students that if you can just get through chapters 6 and 7 of your textbook, which is cellular respiration and photosynthesis, you're home free. It's all downhill from there. Because these are the hardest chapters, in my estimation, and I think a lot of students tend to agree. There's an awful lot involved in photosynthesis. A lot of biochemistry, lots of enzymes, lots of pathways, and it's just laborious to try to... I don't even make them memorize a lot of it. I just tell them if you go on in biology, you will be memorizing the Krebs citric acid cycle. You will surely learn glycolysis frontwards and backwards. You will learn these things if you ever become a doctor, and you'll learn the photosynthesis if you ever become a plant person. I'd like to point out to my students that in 1945, a man named Eugene Rabinowitz began writing a treatise on photosynthesis. He finished in 1954, 3 volumes on photosynthesis. When he finished writing those 3 volumes, I have heard it said, and I believe it is true, that that was the last time in human history that any one man on the face of the earth could know all there is to know about photosynthesis. He had fairly comprehensively surveyed the field, written his 3-volume treatise, and from there we had a Devonian explosion, a Cambrian explosion of knowledge, if you please. We know so much more today about photosynthesis than Mr. Rabinowitz could have written in 1954. But if you... any of you, myself included, would like to study that for the rest of our lives. Let's suppose you say, I want to be a botany major. I tell my students this. And suppose I decide I want to major in plant physiology, how plants do things like respire and make food out of sunlight. And suppose I love this subject of photosynthesis so much that I say, that's my specialty. For the rest of my life, I'll study it. That's not enough. You must subdivide. You must decide which area of photosynthesis you will study for the rest of your life. I had the privilege as a Cornell student to work close to a Dr. Jagendorf, who is a well-known, world-known plant physiologist, who worked on the chemiosmotic hypothesis of how in the process of photosynthesis, plants pump hydrogen ions into a little battery, which then slowly these hydrogens leak out, and as they do, it makes ATP, which is the fuel of the cell. He studied thylakoid membranes and hydrogen protons producing ATP through an enzyme complex. That was his specialty. I used to look at him and just shake my head. I mean, his whole life is devoted to the chemiosmotic hypothesis, day and night in that laboratory. I go down to Mann Library at Cornell and look through the journals of plant physiology, of which there are many, not only American journals, but Danish journals, Swiss journals, Russian journals. And I would pull them off the shelf and just look at all the articles on photosynthesis every month. I say, who's got time to read this? Does dear Dr. Jagendorf have time to read all the chemiosmotic articles that he has to in the field? But that's about all he's got time to read. You don't have time to read everything else about other aspects of photosynthesis. And if that isn't enough, there are whole journals entitled Photosynthesis. There are scientific magazines, Photosynthetica, et cetera, et cetera, that have devoted to photosynthesis. I mean, the knowledge explosion is just absolutely depressing, overwhelming to the student. And then I give you comprehensive exams on this kind of stuff. So what my biology students are crying about is just scratching the surface of the subject, and it's so deep and so profound. I tell you this because if it took us, if it took Mr. Rabinowitz 3 volumes to think God's thoughts after him, his coupler would have said, nobody can think God's thoughts after him anymore on this subject. It is so deep, so sophisticated, so wise, so complicated. And the cyanobacteria were doing it. The Earth had barely cooled down enough so that 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, you could sustain these little organisms. And the first thing we've been able to find so far, little cyanobacterial stromatolites, were doing it. They're doing the thing with thylakoids. They're doing the chemiosmosis evidently. They are pumping the hydrogen ions. They're making the ATP. They're doing what men today dedicate their lives to studying little subsections of it. That, to me, is the best answer I have to somebody who says, I believe in a totally secular, atheistic, macroevolutionary scenario that somehow from what Perry addressed in chemical evolution, that somehow the first cells happen. The first cells we can find are doing photosynthesis. And I say that's the biggest jump of all. I had some material in microevolution, which I'm not even going to bring up. We just don't have time. I do think convergent evolution may be working. I realize I'm saying an awful lot against it today. I think it may be valid in a microevolutionary sense, but we don't have time to get into that. I'll reserve that whole exploration for another time. So you have to come back if Isri does another series, and I'm invited to address that. I'll try to get to that. Let me say that microevolution could include possibly mimicry, how plants can mimic. An orchid can look like a female bee, so the bee comes to copulate with the orchid and gets pollinated. All kinds of fantastic things that the plants do. Some look like stones, so they won't be eaten. I wanted to address real fast. Do I have a couple minutes yet?
Two.
One. The whole problem of extinction. As we look at plants, we find whole groups that went extinct. Let me pull these numbers real quick. There are some divisions that have come through the Paleozoic, the Cenozoic, up to modern times, a few ferns and a few conifers and a few, one or two ginkgos, lots of flowering plants. But there's lots of things that have never made it. All kinds of things that never made it. That frustrates people sometimes. And I want to stop being a scientist just long enough to be a pastor. Because my favorite occupation is actually being a pastor. And I want to address just real quickly what has God up to. Because people are sometimes troubled by this long 4.5 billion years and this changing of the botany over and over again on the face of the earth. There's a woman in my church who's 43 years old and has just given birth to her first child. She'd given up, and then the Lord blessed, and now she has a baby and she's thrilled. I wish you could see that nursery. It's just like what you'd expect somebody who's 43 years old with a first child. Decorated nursery, I mean, beautifully decorated. Now, this is fiction, but suppose for a moment a woman like her, starting at the age of 20, desiring of having a child, had decorated a nursery, and every 6 months redecorated it, and finally had the child at the age of 43. That would be 23 years of redecorating the nursery every year. Take scrape the paint off, repaint it, new curtains, new stenciling, the whole bit. You'd say extravagant. Neurotic. What a waste. And yet that's the problem I think a lot of people feel when they see how God has re-landscaped our nursery before we showed up. They see all the constant change of botany and animals too. Dinosaurs, what on earth, what good were they? The argument that God is preparing fossil fuels, coal and oil for us, isn't completely satisfying. People say, no, there's got to be more reason than just making coal and oil for us. Something that often escapes us, perhaps totally escapes us, is that God enjoys his creation each step of the way. Something that I think my premise is that in understanding God and his attributes, it's not wrong to honestly evaluate our own attributes as a tentative guide. And some of my attributes, I think you can find them yourself as you look at it, are creativity and imagination and a love of beauty and a sense of humor. And I think these things are intrinsic to God too. They're not sinful. They're not divorced from holiness. My argument is simply this, that God enjoyed every stage of his creation, his huge cycads, his dinosaurs. And I think there's scriptural evidence for it. If you sometimes look up Proverbs 8, where it talks about wisdom personified, it tells how God founded the foundations of the earth, marked them out. I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind. 5 verses that span 4.5 billion years, talking about the foundation of the earth up to mankind. Daily, day after day after day, rejoicing. The NAS has a side note, playing. Rejoicing, delighting, scamping about, skipping about, praying,
enjoying every phase of this creation. My argument is simply that the creation was fun. God knew we would have fun later putting the dinosaurs together in the museums, digging up the old plants, figuring out how they worked, but he enjoyed them as he did it. Every stage of this 4.5 billion years, it's very arrogant of us to call it a waste. It's very egocentric. God was not only getting your nursery ready, he was enjoying every stage of his creation. And so what I try to impart to my students, I hope I can impart to you real quickly, biology is really fun, botany is really fun, so lots of work, yes, but it's fun. God is really fun. God has a sense of humor. I constantly see that as I study the creation. Biology reflects this. Holiness is not boring. Repentance is not boring. Wisdom, godly wisdom, is not boring. One last verse, and the preacher will get off the podium here. Proverbs 10:23 says, doing wickedness is like sport to a fool. Doing wickedness is fun to a fool. And the second line of the proverb says, and so is wisdom to a man of understanding. Wisdom is fun. God's wisdom personified in Proverbs 8 had fun for 4.5 billion years, and we're looking at it. Thank you.